RandomChatter.com presents
Oliver Queen,
an Arrow podcast.
Now I will fulfill my father's dying wish.
Dedicated to the discussion of the Arrow television series.
Bring down those who are poisoning my city. To do this, I must become someone else. I must become
Green Justice.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Green Justice, an Arrow podcast. I'm your host, Jay.
And I'm Josh.
And this is a podcast dedicated to the CW television show Arrow with discussion and commentary on all the various episodes. This week, Josh, what are we going to cover?
We are going to be talking about episode 18 from season 1, Salvation, which was originally aired on March 27th, 2013. So... It's good. It's my spring break, so I had lots of time to kind of look at little things about this episode. But so there's a new vigilante in Starling City, but they're pretty ruthless. They are kidnapping certain people in retaliation for some problems that they're causing in a real bad part of Starling City, what are called the Glades. Which it sounds like a nice part of Starling City by the name, but it's kind of the rundown slums. And Oliver tries to rescue these people before this vigilante kills them as he broadcasts the whole event live to people. He sends it out to everybody as it's going on. Team Arrow, you know, Diggle and Felicity and Oliver, they're really becoming kind of increasingly stressed out, a little uneasy from failing to find this guy that's they called it the savior. He's calling himself the savior. I'm not sure if they said that in the actual episode or not.
Yeah, they that was his. Diggle said that was his online name that he posted the videos under. Oh,
right. Yeah, I'll talk about that in a little bit too. But then right in front of Thea, Roy Harper gets taken by this guy. And so Oliver, he goes into overdrive to stop this killer. In other sideline stories there, Dinah Lance's obsession with Sarah being alive is really starting to affect her family, especially Laurel. And also Malcolm Merlyn, he tasks Moira to find his would-be killer, supposedly not knowing that it is actually her.
Yeah, so that is a good point, supposedly not knowing.
Yeah. And then, of course, in a flashback to the island, Oliver and Slade are trying to make a deal with Fires by trading the circuit board of his missiles for some passage off the island, some way off the island. But soon, oh, surprise, they're betrayed. I never would have seen that coming. But in this whole process of the transaction and the betrayal and everything, they actually acquire Yao Fei and his daughter in the process, and some other stuff happens there. So, good, very, very action packed episode.
And before we get into discussion topics, we do have a couple pieces of news here. One is that Stephen Amell has been tasked to lend his voice to the new platform video game Injustice Gods Among Us, which will be out in April 2013. I don't know, Josh, are you a gamer?
I'm not really a gamer, but I've seen some clips from this video game. It looks the graphics look amazing.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. My kids are not to a point where I let them play T games. I'm sure this would be a T game just from looking.
Yeah.
At the violence. It
looks like just kind of an outright fighting game, just a battle game,
like Masters of Terrascasi from the PlayStation. remember that?
Yeah, my favorite battle game. When's the movie about that coming out?
Oh yeah, and then also last week we got an Entertainment Weekly article on the show. It's like a five page article. If you can still find the Entertainment Weekly, let me see what number it is. It was the March 29th, 2013 issue. If you can still find that on your stands, it's got it's the 50 years of Doctor Who on the cover, and it's got I think it's about five pages in here. It's called Building a Better Hero. Is that what they call it? Let me see.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Very complimentary article.
Yeah, and it talks about building a better superhero. That's what it was. And there's some talk about how they went ahead and, you know, spent all this money to build the costume for the pilot, you know, without even knowing if it was going to get picked up and stuff. So some really interesting stuff in there. So
and it talks about some of the details that they're putting into the show that you and I have been discussing on the show about, you know, how what a in-depth job they're doing about getting those details in the show. So.
Right, and that's really what we're trying to point out here, like you said. So stay tuned later in the episode as we point out all the things we saw in this one that were kind of behind the scenes or Easter egg-y, I guess, here in celebration of Easter. All right, so first appearances for this particular episode. None really, though. There is the character of the Savior. You did a little research on this guy here. What did you find out?
Well, I just wondered if this was a character that came from somewhere in the DC universe, and I found out I'm still not entirely sure. But there was a guy named called himself the Savior, mm-hmm. In some Superman comics back. I want to say back in the 90s, right around the time that Superman.
It was fighting Doomsday, right?
Yeah, Doomsday, and once he had died or come back, and I think there might have been some other times too, but he was a guy named Ramsey Murdoch, and he believed that, you know, God wanted him to punish anybody that was deceiving, you know, people, mm-hmm. And also so eventually he wanted to kill Superman because he believed that he was not the real Superman because Doomsday had killed Superman. So
right.
Now in the show, they don't actually ever say what this character, the Savior. They don't actually give his real name.
Oh,
so I'm not.
They actually do. I think I've got.
Oh,
a
they
note.
Do.
I think
Did
I do I have a note it? On that. Let me just see here. At one point he is saying something about the fact that his wife was killed in either a fire or a shootout at a bodega, and Oliver's like, Felicity, get on, and she's like, I'm going, and she's, you know, typing on her computer really quickly, and she pulls up a news story about that, and Diggle's looking over her shoulder, and you can, if you freeze frame it, you can see that. You know, you could read the story yourself, but he pulls the names out of the story. And let's see, the guys. I'm trying to find it here in my notes. They did say his name. It was not Ramsey Murdoch, though. I will tell you that it was. I must not have put it in these notes.
No, that's obviously I need. I'm going to have to ask for another spring break here so I can go back and even watch this some more. So, but that's interesting. I had missed the names in that, but I'm still wondering if that's where they got the idea for this guy, because it was similar. You know, he was punishing people that were causing problems
yeah.
to the residents of the Glade. So it was a similar kind of idea. So I'm wondering if that's still where they got that, because same name too.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was going by the guy's real name. Here it is. Joseph Falk, F-A-L-K. So
well, that rhymes with Ramsey Murdoch if you squint.
if you squint
and yeah, right.
Well, so Joseph Falk didn't turn up any names. That's why I didn't keep looking at it. So I actually hadn't thought to actually look under the Savior. But no, that's really interesting, because both had the same kind of mission to punish people that were deceiving the community here. And they actually had the guy sent the Savior sent videos out on the web, and it was really cool, because I don't know how you found out about this, because I hadn't heard anything, but they actually had a website that tied into the episode as well here.
Yes. I think this was the one I actually found out because I think it was Stephen Amell, even, I think, tweeted about it.
Oh, okay.
That's where I caught that. And it was a – go ahead. You can tell them what the website is.
It's – what, you don't remember?
Well, no, I felt like I interrupted you. So.
Oh, no, that's okay. Glades Betrayed www.arrowtelevision.com, and you can go to it now and you can see the names of all the different people that the Savior kidnapped and was I guess trying to kidnap, because there's like after Roy Harper there's like three or four other names on the list as well.
Yeah. And well, I guess we'll kind of get into what happened when he had Roy Harper, but
yeah.
Interesting scene.
So, but that good, yeah, good pull on that from, I wouldn't even have thought to kind of look over there from the Superman comics to see, you know, about another villain. So, I guess we do need to start kind of, you know, looking around and kind of branching out to other just DC characters. I kind of try to just keep looking like in, you know, under Green Arrow when I'm looking for some of these names too. So maybe I need to reach out. Okay, so, well, since we're talking about the Savior, when it comes down to the kind of the final show-off between Oliver, again, this guy is just kind of a psycho. He's just kind of kidnapping people and executing them live on the web. He pleads with Oliver that, you know, they are both doing the same job. They are punishing the wicked and that they are the same person. And, you know, Oliver denies this and kind of uses the same message that he gave to the Huntress back in the early episodes with the Huntress, the first time we saw her, which is that, you know, there's a difference between vengeance and justice. Is there a difference between Oliver and the Savior, and does Oliver, is he continuing to make or encourage this vigilante behavior in the denizens of Starling City, you know, see the Huntress as well?
Wow, that's a lot of deep questions rolled into one there. So, but what is the difference between Oliver and the Savior? I'll tell you, the difference is restraint. Oliver did start off in a similar way of as this guy, you know, wanting to punish the people that had wronged the city, you know, but he didn't take it so far. I mean, this guy took it a step further. He could have just killed these people, but he didn't just do that. He actually, broadcast the dead in some pretty graphic scenes. I gotta say, mm-hmm. some of the most graphic scenes I think I've seen in the series so far. So that's one of the differences is, I guess, you know, I mean, I guess you could call it restraint. Oliver didn't share these killings, these attacks that he was doing with everybody. He was just getting the people on the list, I guess. Well, you know, it's like I said, that's a deep question. But is he encouraging this vigilante behavior? I think he is, but not intentionally. And I think part of that is the way he's being portrayed by the media. You know, they're really starting to portray him as this hero type, and yet he's done some pretty pretty awful things, at least at the beginning. Mm-hmm. He was doing some pretty awful things. And so, you know, if you make that connection, well, this is what he was doing. He was killing these people, and now we're calling him a hero. It's pretty easy for someone who's unstable to say, well, hey, if I do that same thing, yeah. I can be a hero too. I can enact my own justice.
Well, I like what you said about the biggest difference between Oliver and the Savior was his restraint. Oliver points this out as well. So at the beginning of the episode, Oliver was going to go out and take care of this guy named John Nickel, because he's been a bad dude. And I was also going to say, from the beginning of the episode, when Oliver hangs around the Arrow Cave, he really hangs around the Arrow Cave. It opens. I mean, he's like up in the rafters in this 20 feet off the ground, doing pull-ups and flexing, hanging above Felicity's computers and stuff like that. I mean, it's like, wow.
I felt that. Did it feel like they were just, Like he was talking to them as he was doing this, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I felt like there was this kind of like this reaction between Felicity and Diggle, like, really? What, you know, take a break, or
yeah,
come
down and talk to us.
Yeah.
But so he's going to go out and take care of Nickel, and then he goes, and Nickel's already been captured, and they find out that the Savior has punished him. And so Oliver, you know, grabs his book and says, all right, I'm going to go out and find, or no, I guess first, before he says he's going to go find somebody else to punish for that night, he goes, well, I need to take care of, you know, whoever took Nicole. And it's like, are you still going to, you know, punish him? And it's like, no, I'm going to go save him now, because I don't like someone running around. I don't like, what do you say? I don't like a vigilante or some dangerous person running around the city. And they both give him a look, and he's like, you know, more dangerous than me. And he says, he actually says that, you know, he would show the restraint that this other guy, this Savior, is not showing against these people. So, again, Oliver is elevating himself to a higher level, a higher purpose, I guess. And to some degree, he's just rationalizing his behavior. You know, it is a vigilante behavior. I mean, whether or not we agree with the term vigilante and the way that he does it, he is. I mean, he's outside the law. And, you know, the same thing exists for Batman. I think we could argue that as well, that, you know, there's a reason that the laws exist, and he is outside of them, because that seems, at this point, with whatever the corruption is, that's the only way to get things accomplished. But I still think at the end of the day, he's having to rationalize to some degree. And
I think to a high degree, he's rationalized. And I think he even realizes that himself by the end of this episode. The brutality of the Savior, I think, really makes him open his eyes to a point where he's like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? You know, and you see that kind of emotion at the end of this episode when he's talking to Laurel. I mean, you really see this weighing heavy on his mind. So I think he realized just how much he was rationalizing to himself.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. So, it seems like, you know, 2 weeks in a row now, we've had these, you know, vigilante characters pop up, or with the Huntress's case, you know, kind of return. And I'm interested to see, how many more we're going to have here, because, you know, I think, again, kind of in a more realistic mode, as you have someone getting results and being put up to hero status, that might push others to go out and try to do the same thing for what they feel are similar reasons, but, you know, it may not actually be, you know, the right reasons. And, you know, obviously, right, this guy was kind of, like you said, nuts.
Yeah, I think, I mean, from a writing perspective, I think they'll probably try to stay away from that. But if you kind of look at the differences between what we've seen so far, so you have the Huntress, who I think probably would have evolved into, you know, what she became to a degree anyway without Oliver being there. I mean, I think right. She was trying to take down her dad's organization, maybe even before Oliver was back.
Mm-hmm.
Now whether she would have been successful or not without the help that Oliver gave her, that remains to be seen.
Right. But I think he gave her that final push.
Right, right. And then you have, you know, the Dark Archer, who, you know, obviously isn't a hero or even being portrayed like that. But at first, people thought first they thought it was, you know, Arrow. Then they thought he was a copycat. And then they kind of realized who he was, because he took the hostages. You know, so he's different. So now we have this other guy that's a vigilante who's kidnapping people, you know. But he goes so far as to make it so brutal that I think – most people would think twice before going that far, you know, because he's broadcasting it to everybody, not just what they did, but the actual murders. You know, I mean, he's showing the people of Starling City as it happens,
yeah,
him killing them. So, I mean, so it's so brutal and so unjust that, you know, I think maybe you won't get that kind of thing. At least I hope. I think that'd start to get a little bit, repetitive.
Yeah.
If they kept doing that, but
I think that they could, there could be at least another one that they could do. You know, just have someone else who, you know, takes up some kind of mantle, and Anakin kind of, you know, thinks they're doing it for the right reasons, and maybe even on the surface it does seem like the right reasons, but you know, again, they would say, well, you know, the vigilante was doing it, you know, and look at him, he's being labeled as a hero, and that's what I'm doing too. You know, it's, I think it might be easier for someone to rationalize that. I don't know. I think they could, I just think they could make another storyline out of that at some point here.
They could, what I think they'll probably do instead is they'll probably, go along those lines, but make it a real hero type character that we might, recognize, you know, and that would be where like Black Canary would fit in. Although, that's probably a ways down the line.
Yeah, we're looking like we're going to
have now, but
we're going to get a Speedy slash Red Arrow slash Arsenal character with Roy Harper probably before we would get a Black Canary at the way things look after this episode.
So instead of a vigilante type, maybe more of a, oh, I don't want to say partner, but another person on his team, you know?
Mm, okay. So, moving on to kind of the, I think what is sort of the overall theme for this episode, and it was, you know, pointed out to us in the title again, so it's not a big stretch to feel that this is really where they're going for this episode, but this episode was called Salvation. And I was trying to think about, well, who receives salvation in this episode? And first off, let me just read a definition of salvation that I got from Merriam-Webster online. The first definition is deliverance from sin and its consequences. So I guess that would be salvation more in the theological sense. And then the second definition is preservation or deliverance from harm, ruin, or loss. So, keeping those definitions in mind, let's look at some of the different characters that had salvation enacted upon them in this episode. First off, Oliver, he's gone through a tremendous amount of change in the previous, in the 18 episodes now that we've seen him in, and you know, it took him a while to be able to talk to anybody about his experiences off the island. He's now been able to share his secret with Diggle, with Felicity, with Tommy. And, you know, that seems to help ease his burden, though, as we found out in the previous episode, he still hides himself behind his mask because he doesn't want to burden anybody else. And, you know, Tommy comes to him at the end and says, you know, you'll never be happy if you're alone, but Oliver's kind of already made that decision that he needs to be alone, or he can't let anyone else get close to him, because if he does that, he puts them in harm's way, even if they're making the decision knowing the risk that they're taking. So like with Felicity, with Diggle, now with Tommy, these people, you know that there is danger that surrounds him, and so that he has to protect them in some way. So in this episode, I think it kind of comes right up to the end. You know, they use the metaphor of the island as in the terms of isolation that Oliver is taking upon himself between everybody else. And he reaches back out to Laurel again and you know, says that he doesn't want to be on this island, this, you know, this kind of emotional island anymore. And even reaches out to Felicity, who he's been pretty hard on in this episode because of the difficulties she had helping pinpoint the savior in his moving around and videotaping and everything like that. And, you know, says to her that, you know, if you want to tell me about if you want to talk to someone about how your day went, you can always talk to me, you know. So he's making that invitation to let people in, which he hasn't done before. And I think there's a level of salvation there. He's taking it upon himself basically to save his relationships with these people that, you know, respect him and are wanting to help him out as well. And, you know, he's repaying them by saying, I will let you help me, you know, and it's not that selfish sort of, dismissive behavior that he's been doing in the past few episodes.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's ironic that you know, he's using the metaphor of the island as being isolated, and yet he was anything but alone on the island, literally.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, I think he's starting to get to that salvation where he feels like he doesn't have to be not just alone, but he doesn't have to have that mental trauma affect his life as much as maybe it has been, because I think when he came back, he had this this dark side, this anger that was driving him, and now I think he can use something else to drive him. You know, this sense of making things right and this sense of being able to accomplish justice that maybe nobody else can in Starling City because of how dark of a place it is, you know? And so I think that's part of his salvation. And also maybe he's starting to see, you know, he doesn't want to reveal himself to everybody he knows by any means. I mean, that would be dangerous for them too, but I think he can open up to people a little bit more, with how he's feeling. And I think that's kind of what he was getting at with Laurel. It's like, you know, I can share some of my feelings with you, but I don't think he's going to purposely share everything with her.
Sure.
For the time being, anyway.
Yeah. Well, and we've also got Roy, and he, in this episode, is, I guess, we're supposed to believe he's doing some gangbanging, and that's why the Savior picks him up. I was a little unclear on, you know, the Savior was taking these people that were like tenement slums and district attorneys that were, you know, failing people, and then he picks up Roy Harper, and it's like, okay.
He seems like a small fish, but I think he might have been somebody that was obvious in the Glades, you know, because there was so much crime. So
yeah, he was definitely he probably is a bigger fish in the Glades, but we just don't know about him at this point. But so he is actually picked up and drugged, and you know, was, you know, very close to being shot by the Savior, and Oliver manages to infiltrate it was an abandoned subway car that the guy had running up and down the tracks, which is why it was difficult for Oliver to find him in the first place. And you know, he literally saves Roy from death. But also, I think the salvation that we've been seeing, so Thea's has been, I guess, quote unquote, dating, which means they were just making out a bunch in Roy's apartment, or in Roy's house, I guess. I couldn't tell if it was like a house, or I guess it is a house, not like a house trailer or something like that.
It was hard for me to tell. I will tell you though that I have seen some trailers that might as well have been houses, and they're definitely never going to be moving. So I don't could have been either one, but it definitely wasn't a nice place to live either way.
Right. So so he and Thea have been seeing each other, and I think there is a little part of her that we find out, you know, she's kind of attracted to the bad boy in the same way Laurel's been attracted to bad boys. And Thea probably has some sort of little mother complex where she feels like she needs to save Roy from just, you know, these really horrible, horrible conditions he's living in. I mean, she's giving him getting him jobs at Oliver's club, but he's deciding not to show up because, you know, it's like, well, it's much easier to rob people. But it sounds like the guy that they were going to go harass was probably a jerk in the first place, and probably someone that, quote, needed justice, you know, served against him in some fashion. So Roy's motives may be a little more pure, but he's probably really not going about them the right way. You know, he's going after the guy with a gun, and, you know, Thea's.
Well, I think they were going to rob a liquor store, I think. Right.
Right.
And but the guy that owned it was the bad dude. So
right.
was a bad dude.
Was a bad dude. Right.
Yeah.
But I think by the end of the episode, besides Roy, you know, physically being saved, I think he sees the prospect of being able now to move away from the Glades, like that kind of near-death experience that he had, or the shock of, you know, almost being killed. I don't know. I think that's inspired something else in him, and he's, you know, he's seeing that there is more to the city than just the Glades and this kind of miserable existence he's been in. So I think that, you know, because he's also studying the arrow that, or the flechette or whatever it was that arrow used to help him get out of his, like he was like taped up to like rails or something like that. So, you know, he's kind of studying that at the end. I think we're going to see Roy actually taking up and working at the club, and then maybe getting to know Oliver a little bit better. And like we've talked about, you know, having a little mentor partnership kind of going on there. And
yeah, I think you're right. I think that not just a near-death experience, but I mean, the fact that he hit rock bottom, you know, I mean, he's about to die. He really believes he's about to die. And he's had such a rough time in his life, at least recently, probably his whole life, that he was welcoming it. I mean, he's
oh, he wouldn't beg for his life. Yeah,
no, he told the Savior, "Go ahead, kill me." He said, "Kill me."
Yeah,
which I think threw him off, probably bought him some time, so Oliver could get there, you know. But so not only that, but then he sees Oliver selflessly coming to save him. You know, selflessly coming in to take this guy out. For who?
For this punk.
For Roy Harper. For a nobody, you know, no good criminal. And so I think the combination of all that, you know, will really will start turning him around, which is why, you know, he I guess, did he accept the job at the end? Is that, or did
no? It's just that they were at the they were back at the club. Thea was at the club. She thought that he was dead because, of course, it was broadcast. Everybody heard a gunshot go off and thought that, oh no, he killed him again, but he'd missed and dropped the camera because Arrow was fighting him. So Thea thought, you know, Roy was dead. And then, of course, Roy texts her and says, "Look to your left." And she's like, "Oh, my God, I can't believe it's alive. I got to go freshen up."
Would that be considered an unmasking? Probably not. Probably just a, "Hey, I'm back," right?
Yeah, I don't think we can go for an unmasking in this particular case. So
we'll keep watching for those.
Okay. The next character that had a salvation. This is a really interesting turn here. I want to talk about Moira. This is Oliver's mom. And
can I just, before you say, I'll let you tell him what happened, but this was probably my favorite scene of the entire series with Moira.
Yes.
She has not been my favorite character so far. I haven't really been able to kind of quite get a handle on exactly who she is. What is she, bad? Is she good? This was my favorite scene. So
Susanna Thompson did a brilliant, brilliant job with this sequence. So there was a scene earlier on where Frank Chen, who is the her co-conspirator, to take out Malcolm Merlyn, which is actually apparently only one of about five people. When they went into it, I think it was two episodes ago, they went into a meeting and there was another guy and another girl and Malcolm, and then Moira and Frank. And they were the ones that were making the decision about this. What are they calling it? The inheritance?
The undertaking?
Undertaking. That's the inheritance. The undertaking. So,
because remember, the undertaker is in charge of that. Remember?
Oh, that's right.
Wrestling.
Right.
Yeah.
The wrestler. Right. Yes. I remember now. It's all coming back. So, you know, she questions Frank because Frank's a little nervous about this. He's like, "I'm moving my family away because I think Malcolm's going to find out." And sure enough, he calls Moira and says, "I've talked to some people in the triad and in, you know, they got captured and got in trouble. So I'm working a plea deal with them. I'll get them off through, you know, whatever manipulations he does. And they're going to tell me who hired on the killer to take me out." And, you know,
I like the little scene where she hears that and she kind of stumbles a little bit.
Yeah, she's walking and like her heels, like she twists her, she's walking in heels and she just whoop, trips a little bit. And it's like, oh yeah, that's just great. I mean, if she hadn't been on the phone, if he had been right in front of her, she would have totally given herself away.
Oh yeah.
And I was afraid he was going to like hear her shaking in her voice or something like that. And you're really not sure, like, I think John Barrowman plays it in such a way that you're really not sure. Does he really know who's responsible that he's talking to her right now?
Yeah.
So there's that little question. But at the end, like, there were like five different endings to this episode. I was like, oh, wow, we're going to be done. And then they showed another ending. And then they showed another ending. And then they do this part where she and Frank meet at night on a street. And, you know, he says, oh, I think he's found out. You know, we've got to do something. And Moira says, yeah, you know, I had to let him know, Frank, that you were the one responsible. And he's like, what? No, of course not. And, you know, two dark arrows pierce through Frank's chest as he falls, kind of almost on Moira. And the Dark Archer shows up and, you know, in a modulated voice again, because, of course, you know, everybody uses technology and nobody can hear. You can't know who this person is under the hood. But, you know, she has now been saved because the only other person that knew that she was a conspirator is dead. And he was the money man. So the trail led back to Frank. So supposedly Moira's hands are still clean in this whole affair. So, you know, so there's the salvation that she's been saved by this, but you can see the effect that this has had on her. She is visibly shaken, and rightly so. I mean, this man's just been violently murdered in front of her. The Archer tells her that he still has cleanup to do. He's going after Frank's daughter.
And it wasn't even cleanup. It was payback.
Or payback, yeah. I mean, further retribution, right?
Yeah,
As a message, right? To, you know, like mobsters would do. So she is actually able to convince him that Frank's family has paid enough as it is. And it seems like, you know, he agrees, the Dark Archer agrees, and then he pulls a disappearing act. She gets in the car, and we got this brilliant Lady Macbeth moment where, because Frank had fallen towards her, she's got blood all over her hands. Literally, she has blood on her hands. And she's trying to wipe it off, but she can't get it off. And just the franticness and the anxiety in her is just, I mean, it's a chilling scene. It is.
It was, like I said, my favorite scene with Moira in this entire series so far.
And I just, you know, it's, again, you don't know, does Malcolm, you know, because obviously we know that this is Malcolm confronting her, but she doesn't. So does Malcolm really know that she's behind it? Is the undertaking still going on as planned? You know, what else is going on? So, you know, we're getting close. I think this is going to come to a head definitely by the end of this season here, the way they're moving with everything.
Yeah, I think so too. So, and again, it's just another example of how deep they're really taking this. Like you said, she had blood on her hands, but, it's, you know, literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. you know, it was definitely a symbol. I mean, she knows it too. You can see when she gets really emotional and starts crying because of this blood. She knows what she's done. She knows how deep she's in, and she doesn't know how she's going to get out and how it's going to affect the thing that's the most important to her, which is her family.
Right. Because earlier on, she says to Frank that she will do anything to protect her family. And she does. She uses him as a scapegoat and, you know, basically ends her friend's life to protect her family. It's similar to what, you know, Oliver is doing, but it's a twisted, you know, version of it, basically.
Yeah. Well, and don't forget, they still have Walter, and she knows this. I mean, they still have Walter, and she wants to keep him safe too. Mm-hmm. And so she can't reveal herself to Malcolm. So, I like where this storyline is going. So
it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and if Walter does come back before the end of the season, or if he's been killed and, you know, they're just using the guys that he's still alive to keep her, you know, in line as far as she is in line, I guess.
Right. Well, that's the leverage against her that they have.
Yeah. So then we're going to move over to Dinah Lance, Laurel's mom. And when we last left her, Quentin sat down with her and is like, fine, go ahead and tell me the story about why you think Sarah's still alive. So in this episode, Laurel comes home and the two of them are working together and there's papers all over the table and the wall is covered with maps and newspaper clippings and photos. And Laurel's like, what's going on? And Quentin's like, oh, this is brilliant. Oh, look at all this stuff here. And she's like, Dad, I thought you were going to talk her out of it. And he's like, well, but, you know, she really's got quite a point. And I'm like, oh, no, the crazy rubbed off on him. But So this really upsets Laurel. Now all of a sudden Laurel's pissed at her dad again. And so they have a, you know, they have a little spat, and it comes out later. And again, another really emotional scene. You know, when we started the show, I didn't mention this, but like, I really didn't like this episode a lot, but because I didn't think a lot happened, but there really were several very emotional, resonating scenes in here that I'm looking back on it now. So
yeah,
I think it's probably actually better than I initially thought it was, just because plot wise they didn't move stuff on, but there was a lot of character development, I guess.
And yeah,
I will give
yeah,
it that.
A lot.
But they're talking about, you know, why do you think this is Sarah? Because we find out that it wasn't actually Sarah; it was another girl that looks like Sarah. And I'm not sure if it was actually the same actress that had played Sarah that they just put a different, you know, like a wig on.
I don't think so.
But it was the fact that this girl looked very, very similar to Sarah, but it wasn't Sarah. And she, you know, she happened to live right there in Starling City. So they were able to, you know, have her come down, and everybody understood what that was. And so Dinah's getting ready to leave. She's like, you know what? You guys all think I'm nuts and stuff like that. And it's, but, Laurel starts piecing things together because she's smart too. And she wonders why her mom thought that the girl in the picture was Sarah when she said that it was because of this Starling City Rockets cap she was wearing, and not because it was like a white girl in Asia. And it comes out that, well, I mean, that was the whole point of that scene, right?
It was
the first thing you say is like, well, it's she's Caucasian, you know, not oh, it's because she's wearing this hat. It's like, well, a lot of people have hats like that, but it was that the Dinah saw Sarah leaving the night to go to Oliver's boat. And even told her it was okay to go because she should follow her heart. And Dinah has this big breakdown because she feels responsible for her daughter's death, because she basically gave her permission to go. She goes, I killed her. It comes to that point. And I think through this whole process of coming back and reuniting with her family, and them doing this search for the missing daughter, and all of the, you know, this big secret, I guess, which I don't think Quentin or Laurel knew about this, which comes out. That's kind of Dinah's emotional salvation, and it provides reconciliation with her husband. I mean, because they're working together, and you know, there doesn't seem to be any, whatever friction there had been at the beginning of the previous episode, that's kind of washed away by now.
Well, they didn't really explain this, but it seems like maybe the problem that they had was that Dinah left, and maybe didn't even say why. And, you know, Quentin held that against her big time because, look, mm-hmm. he lost his daughter, and now his wife is leaving. But now you can kind of see why she may have left, you know, this guilt that she felt for, you know, what she said causing her daughter's death. So mm-hmm. that might have been part of the reason. So you can see why maybe now he has reconciled with her a little bit.
Yeah. So, again, I felt that there was, you know, there was a little bit of salvation for that character there as well.
Yeah.
And then, the final kind of thing that I saw, which, I don't know, this is kind of lame, just in terms of all the other stuff that we've talked about. But Yao Fei's daughter, Shadow, in the flashbacks, is as Oliver and Slade Wilson are attempting to extort passage off the island from fires. He brings out Shadow, who's bound up, and they're going to kill her. And, you know, so Yao Fei, you know, is like, no. And, you know, then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose and fighting starts, and Shadow manages to escape. And she's got martial arts skills. Obviously she's got some training from her father. So, you know, there's just kind of her salvation from bondage in there because, she's freed. And, like you said in the brief at the beginning, Yao Fei gets shot, so they kind of have to leave him behind. Well, actually, he tells them to go and leave him behind again to be captured by fires. So we'll see how that plays out. But she and Oliver and Slade, you know, manage to free themselves from a very troubling situation there.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's lame though. I mean, I still think that is some salvation. So, I mean, obviously, it's going to come back, and there'll be more about Shadow because we know from the comics that she's an important character. But I thought that was part of the salvation thread between the stories.
And at the very end, this is just kind of a little bit of clever wordplay that I'm putting together here, but. We also find out that Shadow speaks English. I think Oliver says, you know, they have no idea where Fires is or what his plan is or anything like this. And she says, oh, I know what his plan is. And so that's kind of where that ends. So, just in homage, to the great radio dramas of the 1940s, The Shadow Knows. So, well, Fires' plan, you know, so we'll see where that goes. So again, like you said, knowing from the comics that she does end up being a very important character, and in the Longbow Hunters comic series by Mike Grell, the 3-issue series that came out in the '80s, she's kind of doing the same thing as Arrow. She's going against, you know, she has a list of her own that she is taking out, and nobody can figure out why these men are dying, but they're all, you know, being shot with an arrow, and the police kind of consult with Oliver to figure out what's going on, and you know, she's righting a wrong from her past, or her family's past, I guess. It's kind of a different setup with the character, but I think we'll see similar things going on here for this version of the character.
Right, but even if you don't know the story in the comic or that background, there was still that scene, the very first scene where we saw Shadow in another episode, where she kind of had that look, you know, like she maybe wasn't being held by Fires, or you know, she was just sort of posing that, or they're
right.
lying to Yao Fei about her involvement, or so even if you don't know that storyline, I still think. That there's something more there, and there's a reason why she knows. Why does she know Fire's plan? Well, there's something there. So
yeah, that's true. Is she like one of those? Is she like a double agent in this? It's like they let her escape so that she could lead them back to Fires again.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, I guess we'll have to see what's going on with that. And I don't expect any quick resolutions with any of the storylines with the island. That stuff's just going to keep going on and on, I believe.
Yeah.
So at the end of the episode, Dinah just kind of decides to call it quits. It seems like they've made this resolution when they find out that the woman in the photo is not actually Sarah, that they can kind of all put it back, you know, put it back down and lay it to rest. And let's not, you know, continue talking this nonsense about Sarah being alive. But Dinah seems to think that there's still a chance that Sarah may be out there. This may not be her. But that doesn't mean that all my other research is in vain, and it's kind of like, oh man, you know, let's just let it go. What do you think, Josh? Do you think she's just kind of she's not able to just let her daughter be dead because there's just that potential minuscule possibility? Is there still a chance that Sarah really is alive, or is this just kind of the clingings of an emotionally unstable woman?
I think both of those, because they keep kind of playing up on this, it kind of leads me to believe that there might be something there, that she might have something, or at least still bring her back, or at least find out where she went. You know, maybe through these, through all of her research, she's going to discover a little bit more about the sabotage of the Queen's Gambit. And maybe get together with Oliver to let him know, or somehow that's going to be connected. So, but yeah, is it the rantings of an obsessive woman that, you know, for sure you can tell that's how she feels, but she's determined to find out, whether she's alive or not, you know, I think so.
Yeah.
But I think there'll be more to that with Sarah.
Also, if I can point out, I think this is just an interesting kind of behind-the-scenes tidbit. So Katie Cassidy plays Laurel, and she's an American actress. Paul Blackthorne, who plays her father, British actor, who's doing an amazing American accent. And then Dinah, played by Alex Kingston.
Yeah.
Who's also a British actress, also doing a very amazing American accent. So she's, you know, so these two British people playing Americans to an American actress. So I just thought that's a cool little behind the scenes things, because if you didn't know it, I don't think you could tell from watching these episodes.
No, especially Quentin. I really like his accent. It's a perfect, kind of stereotypical tough guy cop.
Grizzled
New York. It's not New York, you know, but he's got that real real thick kind of accent. I guess it's a Starling City accent.
It is a Starling City. Well, you know, I'm coming to think more that I am working in Starling City, because I don't think it was this episode. I think it was the Huntress episode, the last one. But they used the shot of Baltimore again as an establishing shot for Starling City, and then they cut to using a shot of Philly. Philadelphia. So kind of, Starling City is kind of Baltimore, Philly, because we've got some pretty nasty parts of Baltimore that I could see. Those are the Glades. You've got tough guys like Roy Harper that are growing up there. And I don't see anyone opening clubs in the area to, dance clubs or anything like that. But
you're not a slumlord, are you?
No, but my wife is.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, maybe you should open a nightclub somewhere like in the slums.
I don't know that I want to draw the ire of any archers in the area here. So
yeah, we could practice our parkour down there.
Oh, that might be cool. That'd be really
fun. And speaking of parkour, there was more in this one of jumping from rooftop to rooftop.
That was pretty intense. And down the outside of a fire escape. Can't use the inside of the fire escape. You got to go down the outside of the fire escape. So,
well, it's faster and more dramatic. So
it is. Yeah. But yeah, that was pretty amazing. We got some shots on the roof as he jumped across, and then they put the camera down in the alley as he flew across between two buildings. Very well done. Again, amazing stunts that they do on this show. I'm really amazed that they can pull off so many different types of stunts and keep continually doing creative sort of stunts like that on a weekly television show. They just have the time to plan the stuff. They obviously must be working in advance enough on the scripts that they know what's coming up. So
for sure, for choreography too. So
yeah. Well, let's. There are just a couple references in to comic book and other related things in this particular episode. Not as many as we've seen in other ones. The one that I posted on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/greenjusticepodcast for those of you that want to check it out. I love this. I paused this and I rewound it and I watched it again because I thought this was just such a brilliant reference that, again, if you don't know, it probably goes right by you. But when Laurel's mom's leaving at the end, she says that she needs to catch a red eye to Central City. And then she pauses and she says, "I'll be back in a flash." And that's because the Flash, the superhero, comes from Central City. You see how it all works together, Josh?
See, it does. It works. I mean, they did that on purpose. That was great.
And just the delivery of it was brilliant, because it's not like one of those things where they, look at the camera and say, "Back in a flash," like, "Hey, I'm saying something important here." I mean, it was, it was just acted very, very naturally. And again, if you didn't know, I think it would have gone right by you. And then there were also some other street reference names here. We've got the Adams Street reference, of which Adams must be a main street that runs through and connects it with everything through the Glades here. But they also mentioned the corner of Adams and Loxley. Do you know why that's an interesting reference?
Because Adams and Loxley, I'm guessing they worked on some comics.
Well, Adams, I think, is the reference to Neil Adams that we've done before. But Loxley, as in Robin of.
Oh, Robin Hood.
Yeah, so that's a nice Robin Hood reference there. Robin of Loxley would be the...
I missed that one. That's a good one.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these things, it's like I hear some of these on first try, first run-throughs of the episode. I usually watch the episode a second time, and I picked that up on the second one. I'm like, oh, I better add that in there. That's a good one.
Oof. I should be keeping track of points for you because you are getting some really good ones. This has got to count for something. I think the writers would be very proud of how many points you have throughout this series.
Okay. Well, that's good. You tally that up and you let me know. Are these like the points in Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? You know, where at the end I'll have all these points and I can't redeem them for anything anyway, so...
Well, maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all that we've got for this week's episode of Green Justice.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We're having a great time doing it. And we would love to hear some feedback from you on iTunes. Also, you can contact us at email, greenjustice@randomchatter.com, or go ahead and go over to our Facebook page. We've been trying to post news stories and links to our shows that are popping up. That's at facebook.com/greenjusticepodcast.
And, of course, if you enjoy the podcast, we'd love it if you would share it with all your friends. And remember, if you don't keep listening, you have failed this city.
This podcast is not endorsed by Warner Brothers Television or DC Entertainment. The official website for Arrow can be found at www.cwtv.com. Green Arrow, Arrow, and related elements are copyright DC Entertainment and Warner Brothers Television.